The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
We're crossing continents on today's Edinburgh Books podcast. The translator, Donald McLaughlin, born in Derry but raised in Scotland, joins us to talk about his collection of short stories, which examines the troubles at one remove. Andrés Neumann made the journey from Buenos Aires to Spain as a teenager, and it was after publishing his first novel, Bariloche, at the tender age of 22, that the Chilean writer Roberto Bolaño declared that 21st century literature would belong to Neumann and a few of his blood brothers. Alongside poetry, a series of novels has followed, with Talking to Ourselves, published earlier this year, as well as a collection of short stories, The Things We Don't Do, published just last week. The latest novel is a road trip told in three voices: the 10-year-old son in the great big truck, the mother who's left behind, and the reflections of the dying father in hospital after the trip has ended. Neumann began by reading some of the advice Mario records for Lito.
And so now, well, now comes the advice. I feel a bit ridiculous. The ideal thing would be for you to observe me half your life and think, all right, let's salvage this and this from the misguided man who is my father, and let the devil take the rest. Too bad. We can't. We can't. Enjoy life, do you hear? It's hard work enjoying life. And have patience, not too much. And look after yourself as if you knew you won't always be young, even though you won't know it, and that's okay. And have plenty of sex, son. Do it for your sake, and mine, and even your mother's, lots of sex. And if you have children, have them late. And go to the beach in winter. In winter it's better, you'll see. My head hurts, yet I feel good. It's hard to explain. And go traveling on your own once in a while, and try not to fall in love all the time. And care about your looks, do you hear me? Men who don't care about their looks are afraid of being queer. And if you are queer, be yourself. In short, advice isn't much use. If you disagree with it, you don't listen. And if you already agree, you don't need it. Never trust advice, son. Travel agents advise you to go places they've never been. You love me more when you're old. Our true love for our parents is posthumous. Forgive me for that. I'm already proud of the things you're going to do. I love the way you count the time on your fingers when you set the alarm clock. Or do you think I don't see? You do it secretly, under the covers, so I won't know you have difficulty working it out. I'm going to ask you a favor. Whatever happens, whatever age you are, don't stop counting the time on your fingers. Promise me, Octopus.
So, where did the novel, where did Talking to Ourselves come from? Was it the story that came first, or the voices, or the road trip? Where did it start?
It came from different sources. On one hand, I had this story in my mind about a road trip between a father and a son. For the son is the very first important trip in his life. He has now not less than 10 years old, he's a man. And for the father, unfortunately, might be the last one. And I thought that could be a good and simple metaphor of parenthood. How things can be the first and the last one constantly, except that in this case that's literally like that because the father is ill. And I was thinking about possible magical power of the truck, according to the boy who thinks that he can control the weather thanks to the power of the big truck. But when the trip goes on, he begins to suspect that the weather doesn't actually obey him and that reality doesn't obey desire. So it's a learning for him, this trip. But this idea was very much the traditional male hero drawing, and I wanted something else. And I found out that most of road trip were lacking a good female character. So I began to think, what about that mother and wife and woman, and then she began to develop such personality that she ended up being the total protagonist of the novel. So it was a novel pretending to be one more novel on Ulysses, and then becoming a novel going deeper on Penelope.
Was it at the stage where you already had a lot of material written down that she arrived, or did she arrive kind of before you got on the page?
Well, I had notes for the story, so I had thought about most of the adventures they go through. But when I thought of Elena, the protagonist of the novel, I realized that I needed to talk about a much more important topic in personal terms for me. That was the caretaking, the fact of being a carer. Because I was a carer myself, and unfortunately most of us, or almost everybody, was or will be in that situation. And nevertheless, nobody teach us to do that, not only in medical terms, but above all in psychological terms. The role of the carer is always forgotten, because precisely the protagonist is supposed to be someone else. So I realized that the novel was becoming a reflection on that somebody else who's not the protagonist of a situation. And those two features were put on the same character, Elena. She's the protagonist of someone else's illness, and she gets ill of someone else's illness, and she's the protagonist of the trip she doesn't do. And since I had to take care of my father and my mother, and the thing that impressed me the most was that when my father was ill, obviously me and my mom were taking care of him, but fortunately he recovered and he's still alive, thank God. But soon, very soon, my mother got ill and died. So I saw how the carer turned out to be the one needing care. So this role reversion was very revealing to me. And I began to think that I needed to write a fiction on the weaknesses and needs of the carer.
The novel is told in three different voices as well, and these three voices are very different modes of storytelling. Was it obvious to you that you'd need both the Lito's kind of in the moment stream of consciousness almost, and Mario's reflection recorded after the trip, and also Elena, who's writing a diary which goes beyond the confines of the trip? When did these three modes happen for you?
Yeah, that's right, and that's a very important point for the novel. Sometimes when we sum a plot up, we forget that voices and points of view are the plot. So the thing was, these people, particularly the father and the mother, feel very lonely and unable to confess the truth to the other. So they end up talking to themselves. So I thought, I would like to reflect somehow this need of telling something and not finding the strength or the occasion or the family or cultural frame of whatever to tell the truth. And I thought, well, as far as I'm concerned, I know only three ways of talking to yourself: thinking, talking, and writing. So I decided that each one of them would hold one of these modes of speech. And it seemed natural that the boy was restlessly thinking and changing topic all the time, like a zapping mind. His attention changes channel, as children do. And I thought that it could be interesting if Mario tried to leap for him a recorded letter, as we are doing now, sort of last statement for his son, so that he could listen his father voice. Because when we lose someone terribly, we very quickly forget the voice, which is a tragedy. We can remember, with the very important help of pictures, faces, and obviously happenings, you say, facts, but we tend to forget the voices, which are such a delicate and important thing for us. So he decides to record a letter, which led me to a totally different syntax. The first one, Lito's, is like stream of consciousness, very not a la Joyce, but with little bits of that. But at the same time, with a very simple syntax, because I try to convey the syntax of a child, so I even overacted the simplicity of the syntax, not of the thought, but the syntax. Whereas Mario is endlessly adding something to the sentence, as if being scared of using a period, because then he could die. So he endlessly uses juxtapositions in order to keep on building syntax, keep on breathing. And Elena writes basically as a writer. She's not a writer, but she wanted to be a writer when she was young. She studied literature, and she finds in a very twisted manner the occasion to express all her fears, thoughts, and needs through more literary writing, because she's writing a diary.
And through quotation in many cases as well. She's taking the words of the writers that she's read or is reading and using those to her own ends.
Yeah, exactly. She uses two weapons to face death. One is reading and the other one is sex. I can't blame her for that.
You say that reading is like having a conversation in some sense, but you also say that in your addition to the biographical note, you say that writing is like talking to ourselves. I mean, talking to ourselves is often seen as a sign of instability. As if you see someone walking along the street talking to themselves, you sort of wonder if there's some sort of problem going on. Does that mean, is writing a more unstable, a more dangerous thing, a more unhealthy thing than reading or translating?
That's interesting. Maybe writing is more unhealthy, or for more unhealthy people. I would say that writing is something very healthy that unhealthy people do. But the point is, and I try to reflect this in the book, is that you cannot actually talk alone, because there are other voices in your mind, not necessarily in a mad way, but you address to yourself and you find a lost beloved person, a memory, your other self. I mean, there is always a you behind a me, both in philosophical but as well emotional sense.
You've also you're publishing a set of short stories which go in 1,001 different directions. I mean, again, talking to ourselves has three different modes, as it were, but you've got a hatful in The Things We Don't Do. Is it obvious to you straight away when you start off with an idea, when you get something in your head, whether it's going to come out as something that needs the length of a novel or something that can be done in a shorter form?
Normally, I think that writers tend to know if they're writing a story or a novel or a poem. Although, in my case personally, I don't know the length until I finish, because an idea not only can but should change. I don't trust my first ideas. I don't think that the first idea you have is the most great idea that anyone has had. On the contrary, I think the first idea tends to reproduce a cliche, prejudice of yours or whatever, and the rethinking is what adds something else. So to me, it's very common that an idea begins to irradiate consequences, and then the structure changes and everything. No matter how hard I was working on the first plan, the plan changes. But I need a plan, just in order to begin the journey. It's like writing is very much like traveling in that. Yeah, exactly. In that regard, you have vague plan, you have thought of places you are supposed to see, and you know the stopping points and all those museums you won't see, and the very first day your trip begins, you don't do anything of what you have thought, but thanks to that plan, that fantasy that was fed for a certain amount of time, that's why you are traveling. So a plan is just a pretext. And that how I work. I work for a year or two taking notes when I'm writing a novel, knowing that when I begin, everything will change. For a story, it's different. I don't plan that much. But what I do need always is a tone, a voice. I think that I'm interested in plot. I'm not that snob to say, oh, who cares plot? Well, I mean, stories are a cultural habit that humankind has always had, so I suppose that telling a story is an anthropological need, so don't go that far. But what I do think is that the plot is a consequence of the voice. That you can't have a proper plot regardless the voice. So I prefer to hear the tone, know what kind of language I'm using, and that will lead me to the plot.
You're going to read something from a section called The Last Minute, a story called Man Shots. You want to just tell us a little bit about the story?
Yes, of course. Man Shot is a story inspired on the experience of an Argentinian writer called Daniel Moyano, who was an excellent story writer who suffered one of the worst tortures ever. I remained very curious of what happens with your consciousness when you thought you were dying and keep on living. That second life, that posthumous consciousness that remains stuck to your mind forever until you died for the second time. Man Shot. When Moyano, hands tied and icy-nosed, heard the command, "Ready!" He suddenly remembered his Spanish grandfather had told him that in his country they usually said, "Load!" As he recalled his deceased grandfather, it seemed to him unreal that nightmares should come true. That's what Moyano thought, that we usually invoke, possibly out of cowardice, the supposed danger of realizing our desires, yet we tend to omit the sinister possibility that our fears may also come true. He did not think this as a matter of syntax, word for word, but did feel the sour impact of its conclusion. He was about to be shot, and nothing seemed to him more implausible, in spite of the fact that, in his circumstances, it ought to have seemed to him the most logical thing ever to happen in Argentina. Was it logical to hear "aim"? To anyone, at least to anyone decent, that order could never sound rational. Even though the entire squad was lined up, their rifles perpendicular to their bodies, like branches to the trunk of a tree, and no matter how often during his captivity the general had threatened that exactly this would happen to him. Moyano was ashamed at the lack of sincerity in this reasoning and of the sham of appealing to decency. Who, at the point of being shot, could worry about such a thing? Wasn't survival the only human value, or perhaps less than human value, that now really mattered to him? Was he trying to lie to himself, to die with some sense of glory, to make a moral distinction between himself and his executioners as a pathetic form of the salvation in which he had never believed? Moyano didn't exactly think all this, but he intuited, he understood it, mentally nodding as if at somebody else's dictation. The general bellowed, "Fire!" Moyano shut his eyes, screwing them up so tightly that they hurt, trying to hide from everything, from himself as well, behind the eyelids. It seemed to him ignoble to die like this, eyes closed. His last gaze should at least be vengeful. He wanted to open them, but didn't. He remained motionless, thought of shouting out something, insulting somebody. He searched for one or two suitable offensive words, but they did not come. "What a clumsy death," he thought, and then immediately, "What if we have been fooled? Doesn't everybody die this way, as best they can?" The next sound, the last Moyano heard, was the click of triggers. Far less disturbing, more harmonious even, than he had ever imagined. That ought to have been the last sound, but he heard something more. To his amazement and confusion, things went on making noise. His eyes still shut, glued by panic, he heard the general shouting, "Sissy, weep, sissy." He heard the firing squad convulse with laughter, heard the birds singing, hesitantly sniff the delicious morning air, sever the dry saliva between his lips. "Weep, sissy, weep," the general was still shouting when Moyano opened his eyes as the squad was dispersing, their backs to him, chatting about the joke, leaving him sprawled there, kneeling in the mud, panting, all dead.
The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code GUARDIAN to take 10% off.
Donald McLaughlin is another writer who's sticking up for the short story. His second collection of short fiction, Beheading the Virgin Mary, is a loose sequence which circles around a character called Liam O'Donnell, who moves to Scotland from Derry just like his creator. But readers should resist the temptation to confuse the writer with his stand-in.
I can understand it if the reader feels in any way tempted to see some connection between Liam, the character in the stories, and myself. I always say, however, this is not about me, to quote the title of Janice Galloway's wonderful memoir. I very consciously created this character, Liam, to tell stories about the troubles in Northern Ireland, sectarianism in the west of Scotland, the church and religion for that matter too. Whatever stories come to me, someone stepping in dog dirt is a story that's been written as well. But it's really not about me. The character is a vehicle, and I took the idea from a German author, Alfred Andersch. The centenary of his birth fell earlier this year, and he created a character called Franz Keen to write about his childhood and youth in the Weimar Republic and the Third Reich. And I took the idea and ran with it to write about subjects that interest me.
Because it's not just Liam, is it now? It's a whole family. You've got aunts and uncles and brothers and sisters.
Yeah, absolutely. I've lost track of them. I just make them up as I go along. But that for me was very much part of the project, as it were, too. I'm the eldest of eight in real life. My father was one of 13. And that whole big family thing, the chaos in the very full living room, is something that attracts me, obviously. And there were moments on summer holidays back in Ireland in the 70s, for example, when I was aware of all of us doing whatever we were doing in my grandmother's living room, and outside Saracens were rolling past and bottles and stones were being thrown, shots were being fired, or bombs were going off down the town, as they said, though my grandmother and her friends were trying to persuade us children that those were fireworks.
We've got a bit of firework here from the rain, I think. You've got the difficulties of this exile, this emigration, as you put it, yeah. Always are there in the background of many of the stories. And you've got, as you say, the troubles forming a background to some of them. But you're never looking at the politics kind of from the outside. You're always looking at it through the family thing. As, for example, when Liam's wee bruv sees his chance to go to Parkhead disappear after the Celtic fans refuse to sign the petition. But it's not about Bloody Sunday right there. It's seeing it through the thing that poor old, he's going to have to wait.
Yeah, that's right. For me, it's all about a special perspective. I realised at some point, given that our family emigrated, as we called it, in 1970, that I had a special perspective on the Troubles, given that I only ever experienced it, say, every 3 years during a summer holiday back home, as people continue to say, for at least a decade. As a writer, it's wonderful to have that kind of perspective to use, and it's also wonderful to have different voices to work with. And I was very aware of having the Derry English of my childhood, but our accents and our language were becoming increasingly Scottish in the west of Scotland. And again, as a writer, I saw their scope to work with this. I have two sets of voices to work with. When I started writing these stories, I was lecturing in German at a university. I could have written an academic essay about nationalism instead of writing the title story of my first book, An Allergic Reaction to National Anthems. But, you know, I just saw the potential for story, the potential for having fun. And I really wanted to keep analysis, conclusions and abstract language out of my fiction.
One of the ways you've done that is by focusing very much on the words, on the spoken rhythm of it. I mean, were you trying to capture that hybrid talk?
I work with that all the time as a writer. I always say that's what carries me. I was writing prior to publishing these two collections of stories, of course, and that work I regard as awful. It wasn't published for a reason. And things changed when I tried to use these voices. the voice carries you, the language carries you, and if it runs out, you just wait for the next moment to come to you, the next sentence, the next phrase that will propel you forward. And prior to that, I felt, in retrospect, that I was joining the dots. My very first short stories were written a bit like that. There was some kind of plot, or there was something from real life I was trying to write down, and I was basically joining the dots, and the thing didn't work as a result. But the language, if you get these voices working properly, that carries you. It's much more organic, and I trust that more.
And it's literally a voice in your head that you hear.
I don't know if I would say that. I'm someone who studied foreign languages, who learned French and German and Italian, for example, and I'm aware, therefore, of, you know, the dialect of my childhood in Derry, or of my youth and so on in the west of Scotland. I'm aware of those now as languages that I can work with. As a child, of course, I had no notion of dialect. We emigrated, and the language in the west of Scotland was so different from the north of Ireland that as a child I was already translating and interpreting. Rather, in retrospect, I would see, like a Turkish child in Germany in the 80s, for example, who goes home and teaches his mother German or communicates with the neighbours for his mother, because there is this language gap, as it were, between the two communities, initially at least.
There's a whole family in there, of course, but the collection follows Liam O'Donnell from an unruly boy after leaving Derry to a favourite uncle, mobbed by the weans as he arrives at a Christmas party. It's a kind of Bildungsroman in slices, but with all the commercial pressures on writers these days to produce a novel, why did Beheading the Virgin Mary wind up as a collection of short stories?
I'm very stubborn. I want to tell stories. In real life, we tell each other stories. We don't tell each other novels. And sure, you know, there are commercial considerations. But frankly, I'm happy if I manage to write each story. I'm happy for a story to work. So I'm writing these things a story at a time. The loose sequence of Liam's stories allows me a certain freedom too. With my first book, initially, some people, especially here at the Edinburgh Book Festival back then, were saying, turn it into a novel, but I wasn't interested in writing that novel. I certainly wouldn't want to write a Bildungsroman. But the loose sequence of stories allows something like that to emerge. But the crucial thing is each story can be told on its own terms, and I have the freedom each time to find the way in, or the way of telling the story that is appropriate to that story, and I'm not forcing it to fit the structure of a notional novel or whatever.
There's a novel coming too now, isn't there? Or the novel on the way. Did you know straight away that it's a novel?
I'm not sure there is, actually. you might have read somewhere that I have finished one, but no, I think it's more likely that another collection of stories will follow.
Yeah, there was a novel that has split into fragments, or is it that the novel never quite took off?
The novel I think we're talking about, as it's perhaps mentioned on the website of the book festival, is one where I attempted to bring together two long short stories and to see whether it works as a novel. It's out there being considered at the moment, but I realise deep within myself I'm much more interested in the stories. And the new collection of stories will be a collection of new work and not related to that novel at all in any way.
Do you think that the short story will ever throw off its kind of second-class status in British letters?
We keep hearing at festivals and so on that publishers don't want short stories. But, you know, attending events here at the Book Festival on an annual basis, I realise too there are audiences that turn up here in Edinburgh year in, year out, and they adore the short story. And when someone sits on stage saying there is no demand for the short story, the audience is unanimous in rejecting that. But, you know, is it a myth? It's certainly one that is out there and has managed to assert itself very strongly. But, you know, I work a lot abroad. Recently I attended a huge event in Vienna that focused on the short story in English. And on that kind of occasion, you meet this community of short story writers. I also translate. It's always wonderful to meet translators in other countries and enjoy that sense of community with them as well. So regardless of what the market might be saying, those commercial considerations, there are all kinds of people out there who love these things, and they may not make much money out of it, but they remain very committed to telling their stories, publishing the stories and presenting them to audiences.
The collection even contains a kind of sketch of a narrative method which is totally opposed. There's a grandfather whose total storytelling takes half an hour to get to the point of a 2.5 minute anecdote. He begins everything, even if it's at 3 in the afternoon, with a bite of breakfast and brushing his teeth for a story, and then whoever he meets on the way. Is your concision, your compression, is that writing against the blarney of your ancestors?
When I write, I'm using the rhythm and music and so on of the language, the rhythm of the story to tell the story. I recognise these patterns too, of course. And I love that kind of storytelling in its own way. I don't think you would get away with writing an entire collection or even a novel in that way. Though I do have to say, in Zurich about 18 months ago, I attended a reading that focused on Icelandic sagas in translation. And hearing some of those texts read, I began to make certain connections in my head between forms of storytelling that you encounter in Ireland sometimes and those very sagas. Because you can't hear about the main character without being told about, 10 different generations that preceded that character, and the story then moves on. So there's part of me that loves the kind of storytelling that the grandfather illustrates in that story, yeah. So I'm now going to read the second section of a three-part short story called Enough to Make Your Heart, which is set in the football season of 1971-1972. And the second section of the story focuses on Bloody Sunday. Again, it's a Liam story, and Bloody Sunday, in this case, is being presented from that special perspective again of a family in Scotland that has recently left Derry, and news of what is going on that day reaches them by phone. Day it all happened, Liam had been out with a ball he got for Christmas, up round the corner at the garages. No one else was out, so he'd spent the afternoon, once 12 mass and the dinner were over, kicking the ball at the doors. He knew himself he was getting better. It felt great when he got a rally going, the ball hitting the door, then dropping down the slope, falling for him. He could feel himself shaping up, posing nearly, as he shot and shot and shot and shot at goal. He kept going even when it started to get dark. With the streetlights on, it felt like a midweek game, sure, floodlit. Felt so good, was only needing the toilet had taken him home. There's three dead in Derry, his mother said when she saw him. Is there? He answered just. He felt lousy, there was nothing he could say but. Was like the times his mum would tell him, your granny was saying Tony Devlin died yesterday, or that's Bridie Breslin dead. He'd feel sad, sort of. All he could ever say but was, did he, just, or is it? The names meant nothing to him, that's what the problem was. His mum, realising sort of sometimes, would say, you must mind Tony Devlin, man who ran the butchers next to the newsagents, married on to your Auntie Mary's people. No. Maybe you wouldn't, she'd end up saying. It was only him she asked to. She never asked the young ones. Liam wished he could remember, instead of being a dead loss. There's five dead now, his mum said when he came down again. Did you wash your hands? Yeah, he said, racing out. It was still bothering him, but as he looked to see who else was out. Kira and Annette were playing with them clacker things. Sean was nowhere to be seen. Boys next door were playing Kirby, so Liam sat and watched. The number went up to 8, then 11, then 13. The Derry ones were phoning Mrs. Henderson's. His dad still wasn't in, so his mum took the calls, came out each time to tell them. The rumours are true, she announced at one point. About the killings in Derry, I mean. There was even a bit in the news there. They haven't put a figure on it. Your Uncle Dermot says it's all round Derry, but there's 13 dead. 13 dead and a whole lot injured. Liam looked at her just. None of them knew what to say. He could see the shock too, sure, in the girls' faces. At some point later, his mum came out of the Hendersons and assured them the O'Donnells were all okay. Jesus, it hadn't even occurred to him, Liam, when she said it, realised. Her own family were all okay and all. None of them had been in the march. Some of their uncles and cousins on the O'Donnell side had been, but they were all home safe, but she told them. Their uncle Dermot was just off the phone to say they were all home safe. Their daddy had got hold of Dermot and all, had phoned the Craigan from a phone box. When he got home from the Hibs, their dad, You could tell from the look in his face, it was really bad. You'd have thought to look at him, someone in the family had died. Now Liam felt even worse about not realising how bad it was. It was no time before Mrs. Henderson was at the door again. His dad took the call this time, apologised for any inconvenience. Mrs. Henderson insisted, but it was all right. Turned out Dermot had phoned again, and John Hume had read out the names from a bit of paper. There was 12 names, 13 dead, but folk weren't sure who number 13 was. Could be one or two people. The Waynes were all in their beds, of course, when news at 10 came on. They could hear Big Ben butt up through the ceiling, your man Reginald Bosanquet doing the headlines. For once, the Waynes had been good and went up. It was as if they knew to. Sean was the only one to act up. Kira and Annette were soon shushing him but, urging him to be good for their mammy and daddy. Wasn't there 13 dead, they said. It was no time before they could hear their da and all. Raging he was, calling the soldiers for everything. Their mum they could hear trying to calm him. When Liam went down for a drink, his da called him in. Mear and see this, son. He didn't need to be told, Liam. The man in the TV with the balding head was Eddie Daly. The Eddie Daly his dad had gone to school with, Father Daly now. He was waving a white hanky, Father, and the boys behind him were carrying someone. Jackie Duddy, that is. Dermot told me on the phone. 17 years of age, Jackie Duddy's his name. And Father was shouting, "Don't shoot, please don't shoot," trying to get him to an ambulance. Jackie Duddy. Liam knew instantly it was a name he'd never forget. He remained sitting. His mum and dad were letting him, he realised at some point, were letting him stay up. He listened to the army boys being interviewed, his da blowing his top, then listened to his da and his mum, trying to take it all in, trying to piece it together. 13 dead, 6 from the Craigan alone. The next night, when his da came home, he was livid. They all knew at work he wasn't long over, he said. Not a buck in one but had had the decency to ask, was his family all okay? For all they know, one of my brothers could have been shot. They're all Catholics too, each and every one of them. Did they ask about Derry yesterday but? Did they, Buck? Not a single one. That's the Scots for you. Their dad stayed in that night, something he never ever done. Even wee Cahill commented. Their mum and him were running through the names still, trying to work out which Gilmer it was, which Nash, which McDade. There were two by the name of McKinney. It wasn't just grown men. There was 17 and 19 and 21-year-olds, which made it even harder. You had to work out who they might be connected to, whose young fella it could be. Liam listened to the names being repeated over and over. It was going to be another list you'd have to know by heart. He could tell already. They'd a name for number 13 now. Boy's family, God love them, had been told it wasn't him. And it turned out it was. Liam's mother and father kept coming back to Jackie Duddy. They never shut up about Jackie Duddy, about Father Daly carrying him, trying to get him to an ambulance, having to wave his hanky to stop them getting shot. Father Daly, who his da knew from when they were schoolboys together.
Donald McLaughlin's Beheading the Virgin Mary is published by Dulkey, while Andres Neumann is published in the UK by Pushkin. Follow us on SoundCloud, subscribe on iTunes, or join us on the Guardian Books website for more literary discussion. Just search for Guardian Books Podcast. From me, Richard Lee, and our producer Ian Chambers, till next time.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code Guardian to take 10% off.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.